This is Talking Dirty, Get Gardening's podcast for plant lovers. The video version is available on our Get Gardening YouTube channel, so you can head over there if you want to see our ugly mugs, and there are pictures of the plants there as well. There are full plant lists on our Twitter and Instagram at Get Gardening Now, so go check those out. But without further ado, let's start talking dirty. Hello and welcome to episode 122 of Talking Dirty. Over at East Drustenall Vicarage, looking seriously stripy, we have Alan Edward Herbert Gray, our happy and very handsome horticulturalist.
Well, how kind of you on this lovely sunny morning. And you've got sunshine too in Cambridgeshire, I believe. And I can see a very special guest. You will introduce in a moment. But first of all, let's just say welcome to you, Thordis Maria Sophia Fredrickson. I'm in stripes. You're in stripes. Joe didn't get the message.
There are stripes.
Up and down.
The stripes are intersecting. Our special guest, and actually, seeing as he lives 5 minutes down the road, in my house. So my floor is filled with the most amazing floral treasures, which we'll come on to shortly for Joe Show and Tell. Joe Lawrence Le Play Charmin,
yeah,
I think.
Very good.
Mr. Snowdrop himself.
She's been writing these things down, you know. What you can't see is her hands busy writing.
Notes. Yeah, he's in on all the secrets now, damn it. You can also see all the toy chaos in my house. But
it was the gold cutlery and taps that I was a bit concerned about. I thought this woman's earning far too much money.
Oh, if only. I must have nipped in the neighbours before he came round mine. So Joe Sharman of Monk Silver Nursery, of course, our guest on the podcast, fresh from an appearance at East Drustenall Vicarage for the Spring Plant Fair, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hopefully busy, yeah. Busy.
The weather was terrible, but actually we all did all right. I think most people were happy with how they'd done, despite the appalling weather.
I think it was just a general good time was had by all. There's a lady that comes, and you know who she is, Jane Ann Wharton. She's an extraordinary plants woman. I mean, she really is a fascinating person. And I love her to bits because she's constructive in her criticism, and she always says what she thinks, I suppose. And somehow or other, we don't talk an awful lot, but when we do, I learn something from her. But she said that one of the most fascinating things looking at the garden was seeing all the tulips out. And well, some of them have gone over a little bit, but we do go a bit big on tulips, I suppose. But her fascination was to see tulips and roses flowering together, which is kind of almost, it's not unheard of, but it's, shall we say, unusual.
Yeah, there's all sorts of things. Some things are on time. So let's say Lily of the Valley, that's still on time. That's not been upset at all or changed or moved. We'd normally be struggling to get Camassia into flower, and it was flowering in the middle of April. We'd normally be selling a plant called Uvularia, like hotcakes, this weekend, and they're all finished. So some plants have changed because it's warmer, and other plants haven't. Maybe they're day length related as opposed to temperature related. So it's been a real mixture of things flowering which you don't normally see together, which has been fascinating.
Day length influence on plants and their flowering times always fascinates me, Joe. I mean, I go back to the basic one, which is chrysanthemums. Chrysanthemums from Japan, and they don't really flower until the nights get longer. That is what induces them, pushes them into flower. It's a fascinating subject, but it's knowing the ones that the plants that are influenced and those that are not.
Yeah, on the chrysanthemum front, I have two that are unresponsive to day length. So what that means is that they start flowering in July, and then they will just go on flowering and flowering and flowering, and I'll still have flowers on them in October.
They wouldn't have to be Dixter Orange and Esther, would they?
Esther and Dixter Orange. And then the other ones tend to have a very fixed period. They will flower in, you could almost, as the growers do, they say week 47. You know, this chrysanthemum will flower in week 47, come hell or high water. And so some seem to be very rigidly fixed to day length. And then, as I say, the two that are not are the ones that I'm most interested in, because as parents, if I can cross those two together and try and find more or create more varieties that don't have this sort of very deterministic approach to day length, then I'm creating good new garden chrysanthemums, and both of them are hardy and good garden plants. So, you know, why not?
What an interesting subject that is, you see. I mean, you know, you're a plant breeder, I know, and you're involved with genetics and goodness knows what things that go over the top of my head. But wouldn't it make much more sense to have a plant that's going to flower for, shall we say, 4 or 5 months of the year than just two? And then, and you know, and possibly even the second of those 2 months is going to get bashed by the weather.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about Esther is that as it starts, the flower colour is not the same. So when it flowers in July, that flower colour is not the same as when it flowers in October. So as the season goes on, there's obviously some influence with either temperature or day length, which is subtly changing the flower colour, which is also, Dixter Orange stays the same regardless of where that is.
Just describe, for everybody looking at this, just describe how Esther changes from what to what.
Okay, so when if they first open, they're very kind of orangey. So it's all orangey, peachy, apricotty tints. And then as you go through the season, they tend to get pinker and pinker and pinker. And interestingly, I have actually now had a pink sport from Esther, but it was only one section of one plant. So what I've done, I've taken that plant and I've propagated every single little tiny piece of that plant, in the vain hope that maybe the pink piece, the dark pink piece, is actually in one of my little propagating, modules, if you like. Yeah. And that's all you can do. You observe, and then you have to really act really fast to try and, you know, rescue or preserve what you've observed. And it's all about observation and then going in with the techniques to actually propagate.
Sometimes when a plant sports, as a pelargonium, for instance, a zonal pelargonium, if you've got Mr. Wren, for instance, which is orange with a white edge to it, sometimes it will throw a shoot which has plain red flowers on. I've taken that shoot off and grown it just as an experiment. And I put it in the wall garden here at East Ruston, and it went 10 feet up the wall in a year. Mm. It was horrendously vigorous.
Well,
I don't know.
A friend of mine found a flowering red currant. Okay, it's called Pulborough Scarlet. We all know Pulborough Scarlet, it's a lovely dark red colour with single flowers. He saw one branch on a plant in a garden centre with double flowers. So he bought the plant, he then propagated the one branch with double flowers, and he has called it Little Pink Buttons, and it's the most amazing flower, you know, fully double. They last far longer than the normal ribes sanguineum flowers do. The only problem with it is it's really, really awkward to propagate. It is such a difficult plant to propagate.
You love dangling a carrot, Joe. You really do.
Listen, what I ought to do is bring you some cuttings, because you've probably got bottom heat to root cuttings, have you?
I have, yeah.
And you could then try and root them in your system, because for whatever reason, my system that I use, which doesn't have any artificial heat whatsoever, isn't quite good enough for them. But if you could get it going and get it planted in the garden, it's the most amazing thing.
Well, I'll do my best, yeah. depending on how many shoots you bring me, I can sort of give some back.
So we're just while we're on the plant fair, I'm just going to wave this lovely beauty here.
Oh.
Now, your lovely lady, Sandra, her husband is an orchid specialist, and he produced this. This is Lady Slipper Orchid. Isn't this amazing? Anyway, we'll talk about this again in a minute.
Utterly amazing. So did you get that at the plant fair?
I got that at the plant fair. I cheated. I didn't grow it myself. No. Sometimes things are just too difficult and too awkward. You have to buy them. Isn't that right, Alan?
Yep.
You buy them.
I have tried growing them in the garden here, and I don't know that they get enough moisture. They gradually peter out.
I've grown them in pots for a number of years, and as you say, they gradually peter out.
Yeah.
So I grew them in a perlite mixture, somewhere that's north facing, never gets direct sun. They want to be constantly damp but never wet. You know, they are awkward. They're difficult to grow.
No, that's a misnomer for a start, isn't it?
Yeah. I've had it before, and I thought, well, I'll take a punt. I'll give it another go, because every time I kill something, I learn something.
Yeah,
that's the important thing about gardening. You kill it, you learn.
Most of my comments on don't try this again. I mean, what's the point? I have tried several things 3 or 4 times, and you know, when it doesn't work out, I give up. Until the next time when I go to a plant fair and I see a fantastic specimen, and I just think, oh, just give it
how,
one more
how is
try.
Your How is your Buddleia crispa Stonehouse variegated, Stonehouse Cottage?
I'm afraid it died.
He bought this beautiful, oh, it was a fantastic, great big plant of this buddleia. And I just made the comment, you know, it's one of those, it'll be there for a while and then you'll turn around and it will be gone. And that's exactly what happened. But it's just, some plants are just difficult.
Well, it gives us all, I'm feeling so encouraged. I mean, I know that all of you proper gardeners kill things and you hopefully learn more probably from the mistakes than people like me do. But also a bit like you were talking about, not having necessarily Alan's absolutely perfect propagation setup. Not all of us can have these beautiful greenhouses with bottom heat and perfect misting and light and all of that. So
not perfect with orthodontes. I mean, it's constantly being maintained because the mist nozzles have to be kept scrupulously clean if they're to give a decent cover. In actual fact, we're about to renew our mist nozzles on the mist bench because they've got to the stage where you're walking past, the mist goes on, you don't take any notes, and then you've got one that's slightly blocked and it shoots straight in the face in your face. You know, going back to that buddleia, Joe, an interesting point I think is that sometimes a variegated spore from another plant, it lacks vigour.
Sometimes decided. I agree, and with Stonehouse Cottage, it definitely lacks vigour. I've still got it. I'm still propagating it. But every time I get my numbers to a certain point that I can sell it, they all die again. But, you know, I keep going because, I mean, I'm mad about variegated plants and, you know, I should just keep trying and trying and trying. And at least I can say, yeah, I've got it. I've still got it. You know, I've only got one. I've still got it.
Did you ever propagate that rather wonderful leaf that you brought to me when you came to see me one day this year? Do you remember?
Which leaf was this?
This is a joke, Joe.
Oh, you know, by the way, I mean, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. I have a list of plants that will root from leaves. It's quite a big list.
Yeah.
And you can root a lot of leaves of a lot of plants, but they will never make a bud. So Viburnum rhytidophyllum, you can actually root the leaf and it will live for years as a leaf without ever making a bud. It will live quite happily, develops a root system and just sits there in the pots. And it looks most bizarre because you've just got one. Rhytidophyllum is probably about anything up to 6 inches long. And you've got this leaf sitting in a pot with no shoot or anything. Turn it out, roots everywhere. And I've rooted roses with leaves. I've rooted lamium. I've rooted all sorts of things with just the leaf. But as I say, they don't go anywhere. And there are other plants, of course, as we know, where you can root the leaf and then it will make a plant. And so me being me, I keep lists of all these different things that will do different bits.
Well, that's good because you're fascinated and you're experimenting and probably you're going to come across something that is useful to everybody in the garden.
I mean, I'm always forever experimenting, as you probably realise. I mean, always thinking, you know what? Dicentra spectabilis has a name change, doesn't really matter. I've always tried to propagate it I've done it from division, and then I've done it from cuttings, and I put the cuttings in a lovely sort of warm, moist environment and blah. And I struggle. And then this year I thought, you know what? I'm just going to stick it in a plug and put it in full sun and see what happens. And you know what? It's worked perfectly. And you think Dicentra, it's so soft, it's so fleshy, it's so fragile. You think it's just going to... No, they've gone away like little succulents. You know,
I did it with ornamental oxalis about 3 or 4 weeks ago. I got all this cutting material, and I just thought it was a shame not to, you know, to waste them and everything else. I didn't have any space on any of the bench on any of the propagating benches at all, so I stuck them in full sun, as you say, on a bench in the greenhouse, and guess, hey presto, they've all rooted.
Yeah, exactly. The important thing is to learn from that. You learn, you know, experiment and learn. And then you can pass that knowledge on to other people.
But if you've got something that happens and you've got limited space, you know that you don't need to use your precious space.
Yeah.
You can use an ordinary space.
Yeah.
Now there's a whole cast of amazing plants sitting next to us that I am desperate to talk about. So I think
let's get on.
We've got all kinds of, I mean, he mentioned variegated foliage. There's variegation, there's golden, there's chocolate, there are flowers, there's foliage, there's so much. So where are we going
to
start?
I don't know what you want to start with. I mean, we can start with one of Alan's lovely, most successful plants ever that's in every good garden centre, Erysimum rustan royal. It's shrubby, seems to be perennial, seems to be long-lived. It's a little bit difficult to get it to look nice in a pot, but as long as people can see the flowers and they understand how big it gets. I don't know, you still growing this one?
Yes, I am, actually. Yeah. I need to get more stock of it because my stock's got a little bit old, as you know, with the rhizomes.
Yeah, if you look at this plant again, you can see there's almost no cuttings anywhere.
No,
So it's
exactly.
flowering, but there's nothing to
You
work
get
on.
that in
So
the ground, Joe, and you will
yeah.
get cutting. It will shoot like mad. We've got another one which we call Rust and Copper Knob here, which
Yeah.
is shades of rusty orange, really.
Yeah.
And in a pot, it looks a poor, miserable little wreck, dare I say, like yours.
Yes,
But
thank
in the
you.
garden, it is such as this
Well, it didn't
voluptuous
sell at the
shrub.
weekend. It didn't sell at the weekend, but so don't worry. Anyway, the thing what I do with this is I'd cut the flowers off for a start and just say, right, stop flowering, you're wasting your energy, and then probably pot it up, get a flush of cuttings, and then root the flush of cuttings and then throw this away.
Good
Because
whole thing.
the young, fresh plants look far, far better, and they're
Yeah,
going to
that's
perform
true.
better for other people too. So, you know, this is a I'm sorry,
But
Salem.
there's a very nice range of erysimums,
Yeah.
and they do flower in the garden at a very useful time, that in between time, really, from spring into summer, when quite often there's an awful lot of green in the garden, a very little colour, because
There's some ones that flower almost all winter on there as well now.
yes,
Yeah.
but
I don't find them very long lived.
No, I think that the trouble is look, it's all very good saying it's like the wallflowers, isn't it? Sugar Rush, series of wallflowers, guaranteed to flower in the autumn. Well, for a start, they're squinny little things that, find it very difficult to get out of the pot. And all right, yes, so they flower intermittently during the winter, but our winter is the harshest time for our weather, and the weather spoils the flowers. So really, what is the point? Why not have wallflowers that flower and flood the garden with scent in the spring, as it should do?
Wallflowers are quite interesting because their peak rooting and growing time is actually through the winter. So they are adapted to growing on cliffs and walls. And in the summer, it's very, very dry. There isn't any water. So they've learned to not grow in the spring and summer. They just do nothing. And then as soon as they get some moisture and some cooler weather, then they start to grow. So if you're going to propagate erysimums, a good time is in the autumn when they're actively. And if you're going to pot them or redo anything, again, do them in the autumn. And this is the classic wallflower. You sow the seeds. In early autumn, and you prick them out and you grow them on and you plant them out before the winter, and they do their growing through the winter and then they flower in the spring. So you're looking at what's happening, but you're also sort of learning from it as well.
You mentioned walls there. I remember once being in the Cathedral Close in Norwich, in actual fact, and I walked past, and there's an old couple, and they were talking, and he said to her, "Look at all those weeds up there." And so I craned my neck to look up, because what were they? They were valerian and wallflowers. But
Beautiful.
the wallflowers were not like the wallflowers we see in people's overnourished flower beds. They were stunted.
Yeah.
They were sort of kind of yellow and slashed with brown, or brown slashed with yellow. They've obviously got some kind of virus, and I found that fascinating.
Yeah, it's amazing how the seeds get up there. So with the valerian seeds, they've got little parachutes so the wind can blow them about. But with the wallflower seeds, when they get wet, they get sticky. So if they land somewhere, blown by the wind, and then they get rained on, they don't get washed off. They stick where they are. So, and there's one or two cress. If anybody's ever grown cress from seed, you
Yeah,
put your cress on a piece of
we
tissue
all
paper.
start
We all
with a
start with
packet of
cress.
cats.
You put your cress on a bit of tissue paper and you wet it. And the first thing you see is all this jelly, this glue that comes out of the seeds, and that's helping that seed stick where it is. So they've got little
Joe,
tricks that.
there's an age thing there, because we didn't grow it on tissue paper or kitchen towel, because there weren't such things. We had an old piece of towel or nappy or something like that,
Yeah,
which
yeah.
you laid up on your dinner plate and kept it moist, and then just watched the seed germinate.
Yeah. There's a guy in Holland who made a series of beautiful, beautiful ceramic hedgehogs, flat. They're flat hedgehogs, they're flat like this, and with little indentations. And the idea is because the ceramic will soak the water through, so you put the flat hedgehog into a saucer, you put the
So it's
seed on,
unglazed, you mean?
it's unglazed. And you put the seed on the top, then the little grooves, as you can see by my fingers here, there's little grooves. You put the seeds in there, and then the water comes into the ceramic hedgehog, and the seeds have got enough moisture to grow. And of course, then instead of being stuck on the tissue paper, you can just peel the whole lot off.
And also, it makes it a cress hedgehog,
It makes a cress
which is
hedgehog,
cute.
which is cute. I'll bring one for you, then you can see what they
It's
look like.
my kind of hedgehog. I love it.
Yes.
Well,
Right. So
you should have one for Theo, your son.
yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we're working. I've been talking to moth trappers about getting a moth trap in the garden. I am indoctrinating him as much as possible from infancy.
Shall we
Talk
do
about
the
this properly.
Right. So this is Cypripedium calceolus, or the lady's slipper orchid. And it is really awkward to grow. It requires very exacting conditions. It wants to grow out of direct sun, north facing, cool, shady. It prefers like a consistent damp condition, but never wet. So if you have it somewhere where it gets too wet, it just disappears. In this country, it grows on limestone scree, where there's this very, very rich, humusy soil on the limestone. And the limestone itself is hard enough to lock up the calcium. So actually, the humus that's in the scree is relatively acid as it goes. And then in Germany, where I've seen this plant in abundance, it grows in coniferous woodland. And the needles of the conifers break down to form a very acid humus. It's again on limey ground. And the shade from the conifers is what it requires too. But there's enough moisture going on all the time. So, you know, you take a walk in the woods and it's quite a frequent plant. Over here, it's been so removed and so dug up. There's only one plant, I think. There was at one point one plant that was known that was left. And then somebody found one that was in a garden that was of wild origin, and they crossed the two together, and then they grew it in a laboratory. And they grew thousands and thousands in this laboratory. And I was very fortunate enough to be given a whole series of plugs, which I grew for a number of years. So it is around, and people are replanting it. So, but it's still an incredibly rare plant in the wild. So that's Cypripedium calceolus, the lady slipper orchid.
Something you just said there was ringing a bell with me, because I'm wondering, I mean, we grow, as you know, lots of Monterey pines, Pinus radiata. They
yes.
drop their needles. And frequently,
I was looking in the shelter belt, because you know where we were for the plant fair.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
the most wonderful humus going on underneath that shelter belt.
Yes,
and
exactly.
The other plant that loves acid under conifers is Helleborus niger.
Yeah,
Helleborus niger can be tricky to grow, but it loves that acid leaf mold under conifers. And the other plant I've seen, because I've seen all these plants in the wild in the Alps. The other plant that seemed to really love those conditions was Lathyrus vernus, the spring pea. And it was growing in those conditions without any problem whatsoever. So it's worth possibly in your shelter belt, maybe just fencing off a small area and doing an experiment and trying a few of these things and see if they do. Because you've got enough moisture coming off the sea. You know, you're very rarely really, really dry, are you? Because
we're not.
You've got this ha coming off the sea, you know. You've got a higher level of rainfall or moisture. Let's not say rainfall. Let's say moisture than we have in this driest part of England.
Yeah, well, I've got one of the things that fascinates me about the piles of Monterey needles is that in the winter, woodcock come in and they, you know, they've got that long beak and they're fussing about in between all these because it's warm, you see.
Yeah. I get the occasional woodcock in my woods. And they kind of hang around for a month or so. They never seem to breed, but they quite like the habitat because there's lots of.
No, I think ours are winter visitors, actually.
Yeah. So they're not breeding because I think they breed further south in Europe, don't they? And then they come up.
Yeah, that's right. I think so.
Lovely. Yeah. Well, that's marvelous. I think we're all flow mowing over there.
What would you like next?
Honestly, we've got like two crates of the most extraordinary things in my living room. My living room has never looked so nice.
Well, let's do a little weird one, shall we?
We like a little weird one.
When I showed this one to Thordis earlier, she just went, strange noise came out of her mouth. This is.
I love that. I love that. That speaks of me of the desert to me.
Well, you're wrong. So this is a rhodiola, and rhodiolas are related to sedum. Sedums have flowers where there's both male and female in each flower, and rhodiolas are dioecious. That's to say each flower is a different gender. So this might be a male one, the next plant would be a female one. And that's how you distinguish them from sedum. And they're actually high mountain plants. And there's a British native species which is called Rhodiola rosea or rose root, which occurs in Scotland and higher alpine places. And then as you go across through the Alps, all the way through the Himalayas, right over into the Far East in Japan, the Kirilov Islands, the Kuril Islands, all those islands over on the American coast, between America and Japan, and one species managed to get over the Bering Strait into America. So there's one species in America. Okay, so they're high mountain plants. They like they're really, really hardy. They grow in full sun, but they don't like it too dry because they, you can see the leaves are very green. The flowers are can be anything from yellow through orange through red, really screaming red, rich dark red, and quite a few of them have flower color changes. So as the flowers mature, they change color. This particular species has got lovely soft pale yellow flowers, and these stems can go, they can be as long as this. And they sort of like little mini palm trees with yellow flowers on the ends. And this particular one, these trunks are what are called caudex or caudices.
Yep.
And some species have the caudex or trunk above the ground, as in this one. And this one runs, so you've got little runners all over the place. And then some species have got the caudex or stem under the ground. So all you see are the green parts above, but underneath the ground there's this massive root. And the Rhodiola rosea, which is the British native one, can have a swollen root, which is as big as your head. It can be an enormous root with dozens and dozens of flower stems all over it. So they're curious and they're funky. And this time of year, they're very desirable, I think.
Well, our native Rhodiola, I went to dig one up in the garden to divide it, and I was faced with this mystery of what to do with this thing.
You can't actually... You've got to be on a mature plant. You have to be really, really mean, and you have to just chop it up. And I always pull people's legs because I always say, you know, it's really difficult to propagate. It's such a difficult plant. And if you can come back to me in a year's time and have some more of this plant, I'll be really, really impressed. And most people don't have a clue how to do it, and it's not difficult. And I will do it in another, maybe another time. We'll show you how to do
that
this.
That would be a nice thing. Perhaps we could do it.
With the rosea, you really just literally have to chop them into pieces, chunk, chunk, chunk. Yeah. As long as
what I ended up doing because I got a bit angry with it and I thought, you know,
did some anger management.
We're going to face it.
So as long as each piece has got a little stem on it and a bit of root on it, no problem.
And what was the name of that one again?
This particular one is Rhodiola wallichiana. Oh, you found Kira.
Well, yeah. Talking of Rhodiola, amazing picture, Galanthaholic, who obviously are, you know, obsessed with Brian Ellis's Instagram because it's always full of interesting things. And Rhodiola kirilloei, orange flowers. So you can see why I would be immediately
brilliant
drawn to
orange,
that.
Yeah.
Wonderful absolutely. Orange flowers. Yeah. So, yeah, so much flow.
And most unexpected, I think.
Yeah. It's lovely. And I mean, you know, I assume flowering at this time of year, it just doesn't look like it should be.
No, it's quite useful because, you know,
flowering
you
like
know,
that now.
Yeah. I mean, this is the principal time that they flower. The one I showed you, Wallichii, is probably one of the later ones. And all the rest are pretty much on now. And so they're very useful. I'm not going to say we're early spring. We're spring, aren't we? So, you know, they're useful spring flowers. And, you know, they're very long lived. And they just go on doing their thing. As you can see with the photo, they just go on doing their thing year after year after year.
They're lovely. We like rhodiolas. Rhodiola fan club over here. Right, what are we going to go to for next?
Okay, well, I thought we're still very seasonal, so we're going to go for wood anemones.
Beautiful.
And the wood anemone, I've now been given one which flowers at snowdrop time, which is quite useful, quite handy. But this is one of the later flowering ones. So this is Anemone nemorosa, and it's a variety that's called Vestal. And Vestal starts off with the flowers start off looking single, but with a little funny, curious boss that's in the middle. And then the boss in the middle just grows and expands and grows. And eventually the flower is then fully double. But it takes it quite a long time to do it. So this variety is in flower for really a very long time compared to some other varieties. Generally, double flowers do last longer than single flowers. But it's very useful in the garden because it flowers for so long. And obviously shade, woodland, damp conditions.
They're lovely. Just look at them up close and see this
yellow.
No, we'll put the photo. We'll have to do it just.
Yeah,
but when you can actually see them, I'm so lucky. You can really see them up close, and there's actually loads of yellow. That.
Well, they're nectaries.
Who's going to say
that? And they're the stamens. Because the way the doubling of this flower works is the nectaries have stayed the same, but the stamens have turned into petals. So it's totally sterile. There are no stamens, but there are still the nectaries. Yeah. So because they're still nectaries, it's still useful to insects. Too much choice.
He's spoiled for choice. He doesn't know what to bring over.
For choice. All right. So let's do this one. So we're all looking at the plants, aren't we? Yeah. Ha ha. Okay. So let's go to another bit. And so here we have a beautiful golden leaved white flowered Dicentra spectabilis. Now, Dicentra spectabilis has had a name change. Sorry, Thordis.
Lapro-capnos.
And anybody who knows me knows that one side of my label says Dicentra and the other side says Lapro-capnos, just to annoy the people who want to be a little bit pedantic. Anyway.
And there are some out there.
I've had this plant a long time. It's really quite difficult to grow and difficult to propagate. So compared to ordinary Dicentra, it's a bit more tricky. I think it is PBR'd. So that means that it's got plant breeders' rights on it, so I can't propagate and sell it, but I can propagate it and enjoy it. And that's what I do. And I'm struggling to learn how to grow it better. But I think it's a remarkable thing. I'm not sure where it's available here. I bought mine in a nursery in Holland probably 7-8 years ago. It's quite a while ago I've had it. And I'm, slowly increasing my numbers, but I just love it because it's so different, white flowered and golden leaf.
Full of sunshine.
Yeah, do you know if it's available or not, Alan? I've never seen it.
What was the variety name?
White gold. So it's Dicentra spectabilis white gold.
I mean, that is it's almost as with so many of these golden leaf plants, it's got like an almost peachy, rusty flush to some of that.
Yes, because this has been grown in sun, which normally people would grow them in shade and they'd lose that kind of peachy flush to them. So if I grew it in a shadier place, it'd be much more green and yellow. But because it's been in sun, the flowers are going over slightly, but you can still get the idea. And then the other variety I picked up some years ago, probably at least 7 or 8 years ago, was a little dwarf pink one called Cupid. So there is a lovely, we're used to the normal color of the Dicentra, which is a sort of medium pink with the white nose. And this is a lovely soft pale pink and very dwarf. So there's another variety to look for called Cupid. Whether that's available or not, I don't know. Both of these varieties that I picked up in Holland, a number of years ago.
Ah, lovely. We have every type of foliage covered, I think, on my floor at the moment. Every combination.
Well.
Every colour.
Now this part, I'm sure, Alan, you must know this one. You must have this.
Yeah.
I've been selling this. It turned up in Rosie Steele's garden, and I've been selling it for a number of years. It's Geranium Maculatum Copper Tiger. And because I've been selling it for a number of years, people are now coming back to me and saying it is the most fabulous plant. It grows really well. It's really strong. It is such a good doer in my garden. There are two other or possibly three other contenders in this group. So the first one that turned up in this group was called Espresso. And Espresso had little tiny pallid pinkish flowers and smaller leaves than this. So, okay, at its time, it was okay, but it's not better. And then somebody came up with Elizabeth Ann, which had a better flower color, but still small flowers. And then this variety has got big flowers and the most beautiful purple-brown leaves. It is absolutely fantastic. And it's called Copper Tiger.
So the foliage is like a ready chocolate, but the stems are almost, because I suppose the light shines through them, a little bit luminous.
Yeah, a little bit translucent.
And the combination with those lovely lilac-y, pinky, almost agrostemmery, colory flowers.
Yes, like corn copper. Yeah.
I mean, the combination together is so striking.
Well, I'd say it's interesting that people are coming back to me time and time again and telling me what a good plant it is, and It is a fantastic plant. Some plants I sell are rubbish, but other plants I sell are really quite good. And this is a good one
to be.
The Geranium maculatum is an American woodlander.
Okay.
So its original habit is woodland, and it's used to a dry summer. So it will die down to the roots in the summer. So you just lose all the top. Okay. But this plant will grow equally well in sun, and you get a much better leaf color in sun. And if it's somewhere that doesn't dry out, it will go on flowering. Yeah. So you can find that we're now beginning of May. You can come back and see this plant in July and it will still have flowers on it. So it is remarkable. It's a really, really good variety.
And a rare thing that it actually looks really good on the camera. Most plants don't, their beauty doesn't necessarily convey on the camera.
It's obscuring the beauty.
Joe, I have to just say, Joe, that before you go on to other delectable delights, which I know you will, but I mean, congratulations to you and how well your plants look. They're growing in pots. I mean, just hold that cup of tiger up again. Now hold it so we can see the pot.
Well, you don't want to see the yellow label. But yeah, it's in a 3 litre.
£37, I don't believe it.
Well, I've got about 5,000 of that price. You could do, you could do one of your whole borders just with this plant. You want?
Hey, Fordyce here. Just to say thank you so much for listening to Talking Dirty. You are now officially our favourite person. If you really liked it, please do subscribe, because we'll be back for more plant-loving mayhem next week. And as you're our new favourite person, we don't want you to miss out. If you've got a question for Alan and the experts, you can email it to hello@getgardeningnow.co.uk. So happy gardening, and we'll see you, oh favourite person, next time. Hey.